and explain what this is about. Bohmian mechanics was kind of invented several times, but the person who recognized its actual value was Bohm in 1952. That's a non-relativistic theory in the simplest version. So we start with a non-relativistic theory of n particles moving in Euclidean 3 space along trajectories. These trajectories are denoted here qi of t. I, it denotes the number of the particles. And these trajectories are defined by a certain equation of motion, which is written here. The details are not so important. What's important is that the motion of the particles depends on a wave function, psi. Psi is a time-dependent wave function, the same kind of wave function as you have in ordinary n-particle quantum mechanics, non-relativistic. So that's a function on configuration space. So script Q is for configuration space, with values in complex numbers or some spin spaces, some complex vector space. That's evolving according to the Schrödinger equation. And then given psi, that's how the particles move. A crucial property of this set of two equations is called equivariance. That's the following property. If the distribution of the configuration, so Q of t would be just the point in configuration space that takes together all of the positions of the particles. Say, if at the initial time you choose Q0 at random with distribution psi squared, then at any later time, Q of t will be random and its distribution will be psi t squared. And a non-trivial consequence of this property is that Bohmian mechanics is empirically equivalent to quantum mechanics. Let me explain what that means. That means, suppose you have an entire universe, a hypothetical universe, governed by Bohmian mechanics. There's a wave function of the universe, and all the particles move according to Bohm's law of motion. Then suppose further that in this universe, they're intelligent beings. Then you can ask the question, what would these beings observe? What would their world look like to them? And the answer is, it looks exactly like quantum mechanics. That means experiments have random outcomes, and their possible outcomes and their probabilities are given by the quantum formulas. This is true, well, I should say, for typical solutions of this equation of motion. You could also consider atypical solutions. In this talk, I will restrict myself to considering typical solutions. And this means that Bohmian mechanics provides a quantum theory without observers. That means the following. Given that a Bohmian universe looks to its inhabitants in just the way that our universe looks to us in the quantum way, that means that Bohmian mechanics is a possible explanation of the quantum formalism and a possible way how the world might actually be. Not necessarily the only possible, but one possible. That is what is meant by a quantum theory without observers. It's a theory in which the axioms of the theory are not about measurements, not about what observers observe, but they're about what objectively happens. Now, I realize that actually it's very small. I'm not sure whether you can read it, so perhaps I should read it to you. A quantum theory without observers means that the axioms talk of objective events, in this case the motion of particles, the objective events in this theory, and not of observations. The measurement formalism is a theorem of Bohmian mechanics, a theorem rather than an axiom. You don't postulate it, you derive it from the postulates, That is, from which postulates? You derive it from the postulate that there are particles in R3, that they move according to this equation of motion, and the further postulate that you're looking at a typical solution. So among the proposals for how to understand quantum mechanics, kind of the nice property of this approach is that it has an explicit and clear ontology. It says precisely which things exist, namely the particles in addition to the wave function. Another point I wanted to mention, limits of knowledge. What does that mean? That means if you happen to live in a Bohmian world, in a Bohmian universe, then there are certain facts about that universe that you cannot observe. There are certain limits to your possible knowledge. There are certain things that you cannot find out by any experiment. For example, one thing you cannot find out is the velocity of a particle. In the following sense, there is a certain experiment that you can do if you live in the Bohmian world to detect the position of the particle, but it's not possible to have any experiment that will measure the velocity of the particle in all possible cases. There are special cases when you know, for example, what the wave function of a particle is, then there's a way of measuring its velocity, but there's no general, no universal procedure, setup, or measurement apparatus that will measure the Bohmian velocity. Well, many people feel that this is something strange, that's not a nice feature of theory. I don't feel that this is a problem, but anyway, so I'm just presenting this theory as it is.
I mean, that limit of knowledge is if you assume this quantum equilibrium.
Right. Right.
So it's not. I mean, it's not. That's Bohm correct. Theory. Bohm theory plus this assumption. Then
right.
You have this limit of knowledge.
Right. So this equilibrium assumption is the same. What I call typical solution theory.
Right.
So I mean, throughout my talk, I will make this assumption.
But I mean, isn't this equilibrium achieved really fast if you start in a non-equilibrium position?
Sure. I mean, you would expect that we're going to live at least a very good approximation. But the point is, what I was getting at was that this point about the limit of knowledge is not a feature of this theory per se. It's a feature of this theory in that particular state. Which, to my mind, is important because if it was a feature of the theory of hearing, then it is somewhat open to this objection whether you've got these things in you that are in principle unobservable. But if you can say, look, they're not in principle unobservable, the unobservability is a feature of a particular state, then I think the objection evaporates. That's what I'm getting at.
Okay. My position to that would be, well, I'm not very impressed by the objection to start with, so I wouldn't see it as problematical to even start out in equilibrium. Now, given that Bohmian mechanics starts out as a non-relativistic theory of just n particles, the obvious question is how to extend that to quantum field theory, to relativity, all these things. Let me tell you a few things about extensions of Bohmian mechanics. So here's a particular extension of Bohmian mechanics that I want to mention. That's about including or incorporating particle creation and annihilation into Bohmian mechanics. And this gives a class of theories that are called bell-type quantum field theories. Let me first mention, so this is a way of extending Bohmian mechanics to quantum field theories. There are other ways of extending Bohmian mechanics to quantum field theories, such involving field variables. I mean, several people here in this room have worked on that. Anthony has, Ward has. And this is an alternative approach here that keeps this political ontology, but introduces the possibilities that the particle word lines might start and end. So this would be the situation of two electrons, one word line, the other electron word line, exchanging a photon that would be the photon word line. So that means in this setting, the word line of a particle can begin here at the emission event of the photon and can end here at the absorption event of the photon. So if we want to have such patterns of word lines, then the configuration at any time t will be in the configuration space of a variable number of particles. You see, at some times here we have two particles, then the number of particles changes to three, here we have two again. So the appropriate kind of configuration space is no longer R3n, but something for a variable number of particles. A typical example of such a configuration space is something that I call gamma RD. That's the, well, do we have some chalk? It is in the books. Oh, thank you. So gamma RD, that's my notation for the configuration space of a variable number of identical particles in RD. So here's the definition. Sort of the technical definition is the set of all finite subsets of RD. So what does that look like? Say here's RD. Okay, now a finite subset, just finitely many points. Now that's a particle configuration. Okay. Now there are several ways, because we will encounter these kinds of space several times, let me say a few words about them. There are several ways of thinking about them. For example, you can think of them as the union of spaces over all particle numbers. So a subset of this configuration space would be the space of just n particles in RD. This is, well, my notation for that is nRD. I don't think there's a standard notation for that. And that would be the space of all n point subsets of RD. And this could be regarded as RND. Actually, you should first take out the coincidence configurations, then you mod out the permutations. So you just take the ordinary kinds of configurations, modular permutations, reflecting the fact that you don't number these points. So this is the configuration space of n identical particles. Here's a picture of that. What does this gamma of RD actually look like? Here, in the case of R1, and actually this picture, it was too difficult to model permutations, so I'm basically depicting here the union of the RNDs. So for n equals 0, there's just a single point, that's the unique zero particle configuration. And for one particle, that part of configuration space is the same as the physical space. For two particles, you have this configuration space, and of course, higher dimension for three particles. So in total, gamma of RD is a disjoint union of manifolds of different dimensions. Okay, now what does a history like this one look like in configuration space? So we start out with two-particle configuration. Let's say it's this one. Then the configuration at time t. At some time, there's this photon emission event. At that time, the configuration jumps from this point, the two-particle sector of configuration space, to some point in the three-particle sector of configuration space. Moves around there, and at some time, it jumps back to the two-particle sector. That's the time corresponding to this absorption event over here. As a consequence, such patterns of word lines correspond to histories in configuration space that jump They jump at every creation or annihilation event, and the history, this curve in configuration is continuous in between these jumps. Now the theory that actually produces such patterns of word lines and that extends Bohmian mechanics in this sense does the following. It says this history in configuration space, Q of T, is a stochastic process in such a way that Q of T performs jumps at random times, random destinations, so that Q of T is a Markovian jump process, which is piecewise deterministic. That is, these jumps are random, and the motion in between is continuous and deterministic. The jumps are governed by the following equation that governs the probability of jumping by specifying the jump rate. What does that mean? Rate, that means the probability of jumping, say, from some configuration Q to Q prime, let's say to some volume dQ prime around Q prime, within some time t is this. So it's jump rate times the amount of time times the volume where to jump. So this is rate means probability per time, and it's a rate density in the sense that that it's a density in Q prime. Oh, here I just had the notation the other way around, Q prime and Q. Okay, it doesn't matter. It's some, given by some formula, the details now don't matter much. I just show you the formula. And so what you can see is it depends on psi. So again, the wave function is telling the particles how to behave. In this case, by a stochastic law, the wave function is specifying the probability or the rate for the configuration to jump. And this object here, Hi, that means the interaction Hamiltonian. That's the part of the Hamiltonian that is an integral operator. So that's the part of the Hamiltonian that's actually responsible for the jumps. So the usual Hamiltonian of non-relativistic quantum mechanics, Hamiltonian like this. You don't have such a term, consequently you don't have jumps. In the Hamiltonians of quantum field theories, let's say regularized quantum field theories, to be sure that the Hamiltonian actually exists, you have such a term that's responsible for events like photon emission and absorption, and this term then dictates the rate at which to jump. Between these jumps, you just continue to move according to Bohm's equation of motion, or let's say the appropriate version of Bohm's equation of motion. As a consequence of this set of laws, we still have equivariance. That means that the distribution of the configuration will be psi squared, provided that we choose the distribution in this way initially. Okay, another extension of Bohmian mechanics concerning relativity. There have been several approaches trying to make Bohmian mechanics relativistic. I will not review all of them here, but just present one which I would say is the most convincing one. So, consider a relativistic space-time, manifold M, Lorentzian metric G. Well, for simplicity, we can assume at the moment this is just Minkowski space, but it works as well on curved space-time. And we make one assumption against the spirit of relativity. Let me first say something about that. So this is a kind of assumption that we perhaps don't really like, but it seems that in can't do Bohmian mechanics without such an assumption or a similar assumption. It seems that there is a different quantum theory without observers. That's the Girardi, Rimini, Biela, Perl theory of spontaneous wave function collapse that can be made relativistic without without such an assumption against the spirit of relativity. But that would be a different talk altogether. So this is just a side remark. So here's what the assumption is. There exists a time foliation. What does that mean? That would be, how would you know that? Script F. F is a physical object that is mathematically represented by a slicing of space-time into space-like free surfaces. Here's a picture of that. So the two green axes, you know, space-time, space and time, okay? And here's a picture of this foliation. The idea here is, well, these surfaces, these three surfaces, called the time leaves, somehow define something like a notion of simultaneity at a distance. And that's, of course, what's against the spirit of relativity. But what, so some things of relativity still remain. You still have a Lorentzian four metric. We just have this additional object that gives us this, these surfaces. One notation I will use, n, will be the unit normal vector field on the foliation. So at every point, I'm not sure you can see that here, it's a bit small. At every point, there's a vector that's the unit normal vector on the surface, and that would be n mu. Since every point in space-time lies on some surface, that's actually a vector field, four vector field. For defining the Bohmian trajectories, we can just assume any such foliation is given. But of course, in the context of some theory, we would like to think of it as in the way that this foliation itself is created by some dynamical law. And here's an example of what that law could be. F could be governed by a Lorentzian invariant law. Here's an example equation. This equation actually means that the time-like distance between two leaves is constant along the leaf, which is obviously not satisfied with this example foliation. That's perhaps the simplest law for a foliation you could have. It's a law, it's a kind of evolution law in the following sense. With this law, you can do the following here, space-time. You choose some space-like hypersurface as the initial surface, and then the law tells you what the entire foliation is, what the other surfaces are, in the future or in the past. In this sense, it's an evolution law for the foliation. Actually, we can allow that the evolution law depends on the wave function, but I don't have any particular example equation of what that could look like. Given a Lorentzian manifold and a foliation, then there is a kind of natural version of Bohmian mechanics on that manifold. I will denote that by Bm of f. Okay, here's the equation of motion. So here you, for every particle now you have a whirl line, okay, and what you're interested in is determining the velocity, that means this tangential direction, this tangent direction. Actually the normalization doesn't matter, so S could be any arbitrary curve parameter, and all what's relevant is the direction in space-time of this vector. That's why it's proportional to some vector given on the right-hand side. And here we have the quantum probability current. This is, well,
suppose that psi is a Dirac wave function, many n particle Dirac wave function, and for the analog of psi bar gamma mu psi, it's very tiny on the screen, psi bar gamma mu psi. But now you do that for n particles, that means you have n such matrices, gamma mu are Dirac matrices, okay? In this way, you get some tensor fields with n indices. You have to plug in n space-time points here. What you do is, for the other particle word lines, you find where does the other particle word line intersect the same leaf of the time foliation. So that's kind of the simultaneous position of the other particles. So in this sense, it's a kind of direct generalization of the non-relativistic Bohmian mechanics. That's what you plug in. And, well, of these n indices, you only want to have one. All the n minus one other ones you contract with this normal vector field n. Okay. Then again, you have equivariance in the appropriate sense. The sense is the following. The configuration is psi squared distributed on every time leaf. As a consequence of that, we again have that this Bm of f is again empirically equivalent to quantum mechanics in the same way as non-relativistic Bohmian mechanics is empirically equivalent to quantum mechanics. Now that was a review of existing known theories, and now I come to the new part, to the speculative part. These are my own proposals. I didn't mention the names here. I should do that. I would say the key contribution, I mean, the paper that actually writes down this law of motion, that's Dürr, Goldstein, Münchband, and Zangi in 1999. Okay, so this is I've described bell-type quantum field theory, that was this particle creation and annihilation in Bohmian mechanics. I described this technique on using a time foliation on a curved space-time putting it on a curved space-time. These are techniques that I will use and further extend with this model. Now, what this model should do is generate the space-time geometry. So, the goal here concerns the status of the Lorentzian metric G mu nu. So, in these three columns of this table correspond to flat G mu nu, or a given curved background geometry, or a dynamically generated geometry. I mean, this is what you have in special relativity, or kind of in ordinary Bohmian mechanics. I mean, ordinary Bohmian mechanics are non-relativistic, but you could just do the same in Minkowski space by just choosing one particular Lorentz frame. Well, about theories on a given background geometry, I just described this one, or sort of the simple classical example would be to take geodesics as test particle word lines. Dynamically, when I say dynamically generated geometry, I mean something like general relativity, where actually you have evolution equations for the geometry. And that's what I want to put into Bohmian mechanics as well. And here, the abbreviation that I have for this theory is SHARP-BM. SHARP-BM is a theory that's, or, well, perhaps I should say it's more a vision of a theory. I don't claim that it's a complete theory. I don't claim to be able to answer all questions about this theory, but I have certain visions of what this theory should look like. it's diffeomorphism invariant. And what it provides, the solution of the equations, would be this triple. M, the manifold, and drawn this here, the green thing, so schematically, that's the manifold. G mu nu, a Lorentzian metric on M. Yeah, this, I mean, if you can't read it, this is supposed to be G. This is supposed to be a little light cone, another little light cone, just to indicate there's a Lorentzian geometry on it. And Q, Q means trajectories in M. This means these word lines here, this pattern of word lines, sort of this regarded as a subset of space-time, that would be Q, the totality of all particle word lines. This triple modulo diffeomorphisms, that's the solution, and the equations are such that this triple is then, you have suitable kind of uniqueness give a modulo diffeomorphisms. So, I mean, the kind of uniqueness that you can expect is only uniqueness up to diffeomorphisms. I should also say, of course, as in all these previous theories, the trajectories will be random. So, of course, the solution will not be a unique set of trajectories, but it will be unique in measure. This theory, like VM of F, uses a time foliation. And apart from these objects, these mathematical objects that I've already described, it uses some further mathematical objects, namely the following one. Number of variables, psi is the wave function, F the time foliation, and these other things I will explain presently. But before I do that, some more remarks on the structure here. In this theory, there are, you're supposed to have trajectories also for photons and for gravitons. As a consequence, there's a certain dual nature of gravity, or the same for electromagnetism. The dual nature is there are two kinds of gravity interaction. One is based on exchanging particles, gravitons. The other is based on the dynamically generated geometry. Okay, actually, sharp G is also some kind of geometry, as I will explain later. Sharp A is a kind of electromagnetic vector potential. So there's the same duality for electromagnetism. There are photons, and there is a connection. Of course, it would not be enough just to introduce photons and gravitons into the theory for accounting for electromagnetic and gravity interactions, because then it would still be a theory on a given background geometry. So that's really the goal, to have the geometry generated by the theory itself. A crucial object in this theory is the configuration space-time. This I denote sharp M. And all the objects that live on that set will have this try to distinguish it from the other objects. What is that configuration space-time? Well, configuration space in this case is always the configuration space of particles, not the configuration space of fields. So configuration spaces are always kind of objects like that, gamma of R D, or in our case, the role of space is usually played by a time leap, one of these space-like hypersurfaces, sigma, and the corresponding configuration space would be gamma of sigma. And what configuration space-time means, well, that's a bit various things in different settings of theories. In non-relativistic Fourier mechanics, it would just be configuration space, R3n, times the time axis for indistinguishable particles. When you use multi-time wave functions for indistinguishable particles, it would just take space-time to the nth power. So a point in configuration space-time would then be an n tuple of points in space-time. Now, for identical particles, you may wish to model out the permutations. And when you use a time foliation, you might wish to take a smaller set that just corresponds to simultaneous configurations. That would be this one. For every time leap, sigma in the foliation, you take sigma to the n as the configuration space, you form the union of all these. So this set is then a manifold of dimension 3n plus 1. So it's kind of analog to this space, except that now we're in a curved space-time, and we use a time foliation. Okay, we may wish to model the permutations again. And in our case, what we will do is form the union over all particle numbers. So here, that's now the definition that I will use at the rest of this talk. Sharp M, the configuration space-time, is the union for all time leaves of the configuration spaces corresponding to these time leaves. Or this is a different way of writing it, because this configuration space is just the union of all particle numbers of these spaces. Or exchanging them to unions, we could also regard the configuration space-time as the union of its n particle sectors. And the n particle sector, then, is basically this object here. As dimension 3n plus 1, and I'll sometimes briefly denote it trial m sub n in particle sector. In other words, sharp M is the set of all simultaneous configurations. So this is space-time, and we have n points here in space-time, then this belongs to sharp M if they are simultaneous, if they lie on the same time leap. Good. Well, given the foliation of space-time, I mean, there's an obvious way to lift this foliation to sharp M, so then sharp M is also foliated. Now, in this theory, we have three objects living on configuration space-time. Sharp G, sharp A, and psi, the wave function. Normally, kind of ordinary quantum mechanics, you have only just one object on configuration space-time. That's the wave function. So now there are further objects like the wave function that resemble the wave function in that respect that they're defined on the configuration space-time. Okay, what are these two objects, sharp G and sharp A? Sharp G is a Lorentzian metric on sharp M. That means on each sector, and on the n particle sector, it's a metric of signature 1 plus sign and then 3n minus signs. And sharp G, of course, is defined as the union of all these n particle sectors for any particle number. So that's a kind of unusual thing. So perhaps I should say a few words about what this object is like. Suppose you're given a background geometry, some geometry on space-time. Then what kind of geometry would you use on configuration space-time? Well, for m particles, you would say that each of these particles feels the same four geometry,
So you would form a kind of product of n four geometries. This way you would get a geometry on m to the n, on four n dimensional, on the four n dimensional space. And we would then restrict this to the simultaneous configurations. And so this restricted to sharp m, that would be the Lorentzian geometry that you would normally consider, in this case, on the configuration space-time. And now the idea is that there is a Lorentzian geometry on the configuration space-time, but it's not necessarily of a product form. So at this point, we open up a barrier and allow more kinds of geometries, more kinds of metrics on the configuration space-time than we had considered before. I just wanted to make one more remark about that. But I just forgot what I wanted to say. Let me think for a minute. Okay, I will make it later. It will come back to me. Similarly, for sharp A is, well, in terms of vector bundles, it's a U1 connection, or expressed differently, it's a vector potential, or a one form on configuration space-time. So normally, the vector potential is a one form on space-time. And now, so then mu would run through four dimensions. And now sharp A, when we write sigma for the index, that runs, well, how many dimensions? That depends on which sector you're on. On the n particle sector, it runs through 3n plus 1 dimensions. So also this is a kind of generalized vector potential. It's something that lives on the configuration space. And now I remember what I wanted to say. A crucial thing here is that once you have the structure on configuration space-time, then you can consider equations, wave equations on the configuration. Okay, wave equations on the on this configuration space-time, such as, say, the Dirac equation. For the Dirac equation, for being able to write it down, for being able to solve it consistently, it's unnecessary that the geometry be of product form. So that's a crucial insight here, or that's an idea that inspired writing down this theory and following this approach. So if for the wave function it's not necessary that the geometry and configuration space-time be of product form, then why not drop this assumption? Also, for the, I mean, the same is true of the vector potential. And in fact, one often uses vector potentials that are not of product form by using vector potentials that include something like the Coulomb interaction potential. That is a simple example of something that is used on configuration space-time as, I mean, it's also used in ordinary quantum mechanics. And that is not of a product form. Okay. Now I have introduced the objects, the mathematical objects of the theory. Now I have to say what the dynamical laws are. First of all, there is a very strict hierarchical structure, kind of three levels, first level, second level, third level. Let me explain what that means, that diagram. In Bohmian mechanics, you have this two-level structure. There's the wave function, and there are the particles. And this parallel means that the time evolution of the particle configuration depends on the wave function, but the time evolution of the wave function does not depend on the actual particle configuration. That means you can actually solve the Schrödinger equation without knowing what the initial condition for the particle configuration was. So it's a hierarchical structure. Two objects, two equations, and one influences the other, but not vice versa. Here, the situation is similar, except that you have twice the same situation. So it's still true that the wave function influences the motion of the particles, but the evolution of the wave function itself is independent of, say, the initial configuration of the particles. And here we have the situation that the evolution of the wave function depends on sharp G and sharp A, but at the same time, the evolution of sharp G and sharp A is independent of the wave function in the sense that for solving the equations, the evolution equations, you don't even have to know what the initial wave function was. Now, here are the laws. First law is the law for G. What's G? Well, perhaps that's the one object that I haven't really explained yet, in a way. Because G, of course, yeah, that's just G mu nu. That's the four geometry on space-time. But what I was talking of before was a geometry or a metric on configuration space-time. So you can imagine that, oh yeah, once we have the metric on configuration space-time, we can write down things like the Dirac equation, so we have an evolution of the wave function. We can write down things like the law of motion for the Bohmian particles, fine. But, well, how do we get a geometry on space-time? Well, you might first ask, do we want the geometry on space-time at all? Maybe we don't want that. I think we do want that, because if in the end, on the space-time manifold, okay, we have some trajectories, but no geometry, then actually these trajectories won't tell us much, because, I mean, using diffeomorphisms, we can kind of basically map any end trajectories to any other end trajectories. I'm exaggerating a bit, but I would say it's crucial for the theory to make good sense that the theory also provides this four geometry. You remember that I said earlier the output of the theory, that's this triple. So it's the manifold, four geometry, and trajectories on the manifold. So where do we get four geometry from? Recall that the usual way, the usual connection between the sharp geometry and the four geometry is you start with a given four geometry and construct the sharp geometry in this way. Now we do the opposite. We consider the sharp geometry as given and construct the four geometry from it. So here it's the sharp geometry that has an evolution law of its own, and the four geometry that's governed by it. And here's what the law is. I haven't written down really all the details. It's a bit written down schematically. The four geometry at a particular point is what you obtain by taking the sharp geometry, configuration space-time, and the actual configuration plus this one point. This is sort of the metric that the n plus first particle would see if it were at x. What does that look like? Well, suppose your the sharp geometry looks like has the property that it is singular at coincidence configurations, which is what it should do. Then what you get for the four geometry is something like this. I mean,
I'm not trying to draw a curved geometry. You know, y'all know these pictures for illustrating curved geometry, where you have like a surface, and then it has a hole, I mean, like a singularity, okay? Since I can't really draw these two-dimensional pictures, I will draw it one-dimensional, okay? So this is something like like a black hole, okay, a singularity here. And in this sense, using this kind of diagram, then this four geometry should look roughly like this. These are the positions in space of the actual configuration of the boron particles, and this is what the four geometry looks like. Because that is what the next particle, if you add another particle here, what you would see, as soon as it gets close to one of the particles that are already there, it actually feels this gravitational pull. Good. So the structure here is the sharp geometry and the actual configuration of particles together, they define a four geometry. I find this is a nice observation. So the observation is that if you have a sharp geometry anyway, and if you have particle configurations anyway, then you get the four geometry for free. So there's a certain difference here actually between the Q and the G, because the Q, you have to specify initial conditions for the Q, because it's governed by the psi, whereas the G is actually a function of sharp G and Q. Okay, then the next few laws are not so exciting. They're kind of the normal thing we've seen before. So here's the law for the configuration. I mean, there's a certain jump rate. I didn't bother to write down a formula. It's just some expression depending on sharp G, sharp A, the wave function, and of course you plug in the actual configuration. Between the jumps, there's continuous motion given by some differential equation. Again, depending on all these things. Here I'll just emphasize that this S, this time parameter, is actually an arbitrary parameter, but it's best chosen. The time coordinate is best chosen such that you always have constant time value on your on every leap of the foliation. So you would choose a parameterization of the foliation. Okay, so basically you can apply known techniques, known ways of defining such equations. The same for psi. Psi evolves by some kind of Schrödinger equation, right? Which should be something like sort of a kind of Dirac equation or what have you for gravitons and for photons, should include some creation and annihilation terms that correspond to photon emission and absorption, let's say, graviton emission and absorption, things like that. So these details, there's not much new about these details. Now we come to something interesting. What are the laws for sharp G and sharp A? Now this is completely new. Okay, there are three equations for that. One equation concerns the time foliation. Here sharp N. Remember, n was the unit normal vector of the time foliation. Sharp n is the corresponding vector field on configuration space-time. So sharp n is the unit normal vector field on sharp f. Sharp f was the the time foliation to the configuration space. And here I recycled an equation that I had in the four-dimensional case. Now I kind of lifted this equation to the 3n plus 1 dimensional case. Okay, same equation, but now in a different dimension and means something else. What it governs is a certain relation between the metric, sharp G, and the foliation. In particular, this will guarantee that the foliation is actually space-like, even though the metric is something that we haven't even defined yet, something that's evolving, something that's not known before. Okay, this equation will make sure the foliation is space-like. Next equation, I like to call this equation Sharpe-Einstein, because it's just the lift of the Einstein equation to higher dimension. So it's the same equation. This means you have this Lorentzian metric sharp G. Now you form its Ricci tensor, sharp R, scalar curvature sharp R. Okay? So this is the Einstein curvature tensor if you look at it on the n particle sector of configuration space-time, then this is the 3n plus 1 dimensional Einstein equation. You just have this kind of equation for the Sharpe metric and the Sharpe Maxwell equations for the Sharpe vector potential. So these are the same equations as you know. These are the Maxwell equations in different dimensions, in higher dimensions. Okay, one thing is missing about these laws. What are the source terms? What does that mean, source terms? I've written down these two equations again. So this is Sharpe-Einstein, this is Sharpe-Maxwell. And the right-hand side, these are the source terms. Okay, of course these I have to specify. So what would that be like? I would say for gravity, my proposal is it has two contributions. One is, comes from electromagnetism. That means you take the Sharpe electromagnetic field. Well, Sharpe F is kind of the, I had that very briefly on the other slide, perhaps I could say it again. Sharpe F is, you start with the one form sharp A, and you form the exterior derivative of that, the anti-symmetric derivative. So that's kind of the field tensor associated with that connection. Okay, this is kind of the standard formula how you would form a stressed energy tensor from the electromagnetic field. Now you lift this formula to 3n plus 1 dimensions, you get a way of defining the source term from the electromagnetic field. For the particles, the term should be something like this, something that's concentrated on the diagonal, something that is peaked on the coincidence configuration. So this is in a way similar to the classical source term for a point particle in the Einstein equation, except that now instead of having the mass as determining the size of the source term, now you have here the product of masses. For the Maxwell equation, you have the same here. You have the product of the charges of the particles. And this you take, it's again concentrated on the diagonal, on the coincidence configurations where two particles meet. And this would be the source term in the Maxwell equations, in the Sharpe Maxwell, I should say. Note that these source terms, sharp T, sharp J, are independent of psi, independent of Q, independent of G, and that what was expressed by this three-level hierarchy. Similar theories. Okay, I'd like to mention the work of Michael Kiesling, 2004. He has designed a model, certain models of classical and Bohmian mechanics with a vector potential, sharp A, actually the notation is his, on more or less the configuration space. Actually, his model is exactly a function of configuration space. It's a slightly different space, but this difference doesn't matter now. Another example that I should connect to is QED in Coulomb gauge. Suppose we have flat space-time. So we just, at the moment now, we don't worry about gravity, just electromagnetism, okay? So then the Hilbert space would be the Fock space of the charges, tensor, the Fock space of the quantized electromagnetic field, and the Hamiltonian has several contributions, the free Hamiltonian of the charges, free Hamiltonian of the photons, creation and annihilation, and finally the Coulomb potential. Now this Hamiltonian actually fits into the scheme of sharp BM when you understand the Coulomb potential as the zero component of this sharp A, of the vector potential on configuration space time. And you said all the other components of sharp A to zero. Because then this is a potential. Well, I mean, the Coulomb potential is, of course, a scalar potential, but that's a special case of vector potential. So let's regard it here as a vector potential. It's defined on configuration space, or on configuration space-time. It happens to be time-independent, but that's just a special case. It's a special solution of the Sharpe-Maxwell equation for exactly the source term I had before, one concentrated on the coincidence configurations. For where we assume that the sharp G is just flat, and the foliation sharp F is just parallel hyperplanes, which is also kind of the simplest solution that you could think of, the simplest case, stationary solution. Of course, sort of in the general case, you wouldn't have any stationary solutions, but if you assume here that everything is flat, then this would be a special solution. Indeed, this structure of QED in the Coulomb gauge is something that inspired this structure of sharp BM, because it looks very much as if you had a vector potential on the configuration space-time, which is not of a product form, so it's really an object on configuration space-time. So if you feel that the theory generates all these potentials, the geometry and the vector potential itself, then you're led to regard this Coulomb potential as the solution of a Maxwell equation. And that's where the Sharpe-Maxwell equation comes from, or how you could arrive at it. How does that connect to the field operators of QED? So in QED, you'd have A mu of x. It's hardly readable on the screen. So A mu of x. X is a space-time point, and these are operators. Okay. So what do these operators have to do with this sharp A field? Here's what they have to do with it. The operator can be understood as multiplication by sharp A plus a photon creation term plus a photon annihilation term. So that means actually sort of if you take out the gravity part out of sharp BM and use these special assumptions, then you can actually get back QED from sharp BM. So that somehow suggests that that this theory, sharp BM, which was constructed in a way that did not rely on anything like quantization, that it was constructed using rather the question, well, for being able to write down Bohmian equations of motion for the particles and a kind of Schrödinger equation for the wave function. What kind of mathematical objects do you need for that? What would be the simplest way of providing these objects? So the strategy that led to this theory was kind of independent of the notion of quantization. I never quantized. But it seems, well, this connection here suggests that the result may be equivalent to what you get when you quantize, in this case, the Maxwell's equations. So this suggests that perhaps one would have arrived at the same result by starting out from the quantized Maxwell equations, from QED, and then trying to add Bohmian trajectories to it. I hope, well, that's a kind of vision, that one could get a similar link to quantum gravity. Where I would make the link is the operators, g mu nu of x, where x, any spacetime point. So I would envision the following connection, that when you start from sharp bn, that these operators can actually be defined as multiplication by sharp g plus graviton creation plus graviton annihilation. Or conversely, that one could start from such operators and obtain sharp g and g from it. I wrote it down here, what the formula should look like. I wrote it down for g, for geometry. The reason why I wrote it down in this way was that's part of the output, whereas sharp g is kind of part of the internal variables for defining the evolution. And, well, suppose you're given quantum gravity theory, you're given these operators, then you're not interested anymore in defining the kind of functions that that sharp bm used for defining its evolution, but you already have the evolution of everything, but the that primitive ontology, that means the trajectories and the four geometry, and here's how you get the four geometry. So, I will not try to give details.
Can I just ask a quick question?
Sure.
So presumably in the classical limit, you want your four geometry to obey the Einstein equation.
Right.
Somehow that hasn't come out of the theory.
Right.
Now, in theory, you have the Einstein equation in this higher dimensional sharp configuration space-time. Now, I mean, yeah, I'm just guessing. I mean, because the Einstein equation is non-linear, I would have guessed that while then you're not going to get the Einstein equation in this reduced four geometry. I mean, is that just a wrong guess? I mean, is there any...
Yeah, and the causal theories you can to supply this, but there are other problems that arise when you have always fitting five dimensions.
Right. I mean, is there any?
My answer is I don't know.
Because I mean that would, if you were asking, well, you are asking, that does this theory relate to physics? Linked to quantum gravity, I mean, we don't really have a quantum gravity anyway. So, I mean, I would say that the first question is, well, can you reduce to classical gravity?
Yeah, that's...
Say for two particles.
That's, of course...
So, for two, say you had two particles, you start...
Crucial question.
Models, like, or, what is it, seven-dimensional configurations based on the Einstein equations on it, and you want to somehow get down to the Einstein equations in four-dimensional space-time.
Right, that's a crucial question, and I don't have an answer to that. So I don't know whether the classical Einstein equation comes out. I don't know in which regime and in which conditions or assumptions it comes out, or sort of any details how it works. So I would hope, of course, that the Einstein equation comes out. I would expect that sort of that there are two contributions, one coming from the sharp G, the other coming from the graviton particles. Similarly for electromagnetism, I would expect that you get the classical Maxwell equations from two contributions, one coming from the sharp A, one coming from the photon trajectories. But, I mean, that's a hope.
What Alex said sounds like, well, in the clues of time, usually you say, well, some of these extra dimensions maybe are just very small or something, and effectively the metric associated with those dimensions ends up acting as a source on the lower dimensional Einstein equation. Okay, that's pretty well studied.
Yeah, but the problem
it
here is that
as if it's anything like that.
No. You cannot exactly this.
It's not the idea here that any of these dimensions should be small or petrified. So
it does look like, as I said, at first sight, I guess, you think, my God, this is going to be a big problem.
I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe the question is, do we really need to sort of, is there a conceptual difference between a five-dimensional configuration space, four-dimensional space? So if we want to reduce a five-dimensional configuration space to a four-dimensional space-time, or maybe we want to say that there is some other connection between a configuration space and a space-time.
Remind me on that. I mean, but Roderick was saying you want to have trajectories on orbit space-time with a metric on orbit space-time.
Right.
And if you're doing that, then surely in the classical limit, you've got to have a metric in the usual geometry.
Right. I could make a guess that you see for kind of coherent states that look like products, then that sort of this could be a relevant regime, right? When you have situations or regions where such an equation is approximately true, okay, then you could hope that sort of the equation for sharp G directly gives you an equation for G.
Yeah, it just sounds that, I mean, if the equations are linear, if you're in a linear approximation, then it sounds as if that would work. With non-linear equations on this higher dimensional configuration space-time, it sounds as if it works.
I don't know. Yeah, let me just say a few words of conclusion, and then we can go on with further discussion, if you like. So, very brief summary. Bohmian mechanics is a theory that can be regarded as a kind of quantum mechanics without the weirdness, because in Bohmian mechanics you can understand everything that happens, there are no paradoxes, you know precisely what happens, you know all the, can compute all the trajectories. Second point, if Bohmian mechanics is right, then it seems that we need to revise relativity in the sense that we introduce a time foliation. While I don't claim that this is this statement is in any way proven, there is no proof that you can't do Bohmian mechanics without a time foliation. But sort of that is my opinion. I mean, after thinking about it for a while, I don't see how it could be done. Then this new speculative proposal, SHARP-BM, that's a vision of a kind of quantum gravity theory without minus the weirdness, based on these two objects, the configuration space-time, set of simultaneous the set of all sets of simultaneous points, and sharp G, the Lorentzian metric on the configuration space-time. Thank you very much.
with regard to empirical equivalence of this, because it seems that, you know, for a very trivial concern, it seems that when you look at a theory of gravity with Bohmian particles in it, Bohmian particles should curve space-time, and that should be observable. And there should be an empirical effect due to the presence of Bohmian particles. What about this?
Yeah, they should. I mean, let's see. What is the thing that they curve? I mean, they curve certainly this G, okay? And, well, they, in a sense, they don't curve the sharp G, because sharp G doesn't even depend on it. Actual configuration, so it doesn't depend on the initial actual configuration, because sharp G is something uncomfortable.
It lays in bit.
Right, it's so that for all configurations, all conceivable configurations anyway, N will have its singularities at the coincidence configurations. Okay, so what you have is that the geometry of space-time actually is curved at the actual Bohmian positions.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying, so that should be observable in a way. Well, if the geometry of space-time is curved, then if you have a light, if you have light that passes by, then it is bent.
Yeah, I mean, that's of course what happened. I mean, in the Bohmian universe, the sun would consist of Bohmian particles, and we actually do observe that light is bent by the sun. What you have in mind, that you should be able to I'm not sure what you have in mind.
No.
I mean, it's somehow not clear.
No,
perhaps you have in mind that you should be able to observe more than sort of the limits of knowledge in Bohmian mechanics would permit. But then you have to also be careful about what are the limits of knowledge about observing this this more geometry. Probably, it's not so easy to observe microscopic details of the spore geometry.
Now, I'm concerned, well, my concern is just for the fact that we observe certain light bending. If we interpret the whole picture in terms of Bohmian particles, then is there going to be more light bending or less? Or because it seems that you add, you know, to matter particles, whatever sits there, to baryonic matter. You add these things, which are not baryonic matter. So if they have mass, then probably there's more light bending or less light bending, or I don't know, or if it somehow solves any of the big problems that matter, I don't know, cosmological. My concern is with empirical adequacy to the actual light bending observed, let's say, when astronomers do their measurements. Is there going to be more of it or less of it?
I don't see any reason to
believe there is
that
there
is,
there is more mass than usual.
Why is there more mass than usual?
Maybe
so maybe we need to discuss that afterwards.
Well, no, I mean, I just think, obviously, I mean, you're classically, it's a law that, look, if there's a mass somewhere, then it generates gravitational field by certain classical law. And you seem to be assuming that, well, okay, we're thinking about this theory, which is a completely different kind of dynamics. Well, that if there's a mass there inside the wave function, then it's going to generate a gravitational field in the usual way. But, you know, if you take that line of reasoning, you could just as well say, as some people do, well, why is it that the Bohmian particle is charged? It has this wiggling trajectory. Why doesn't it radiate? Right? Now, you know, an accelerating charge is supposed to radiate, but that's classical electrodynamics. If you look at the Bohmian version of QED, you know, it's just not classical electrodynamics. So you have these wiggling charges, they don't necessarily radiate like classical charges. So I think something like
I see the point about electrodynamics. I'm not sure about the analogy with curved space time. Because there is curvature of space-time, which is there, and it was observable.
No? Well, sure, I mean, electromagnetic radiation is observable. But, you know, the electromagnetic radiation that the Bohmian theory predicts from an atom
is not given by saying, right, take right, the point of charge right, right, and use that as a source of Maxwell's equation.
I agree. As far as electromagnetism is concerned, yes.
I have a very general question. What is the definition of a particle in your theory? Especially, what is the graviton? Is there something conceptually different between the graviton and the source particles?
I'm not sure I understand the question. What's the definition of a particle? Particle is a point that moves around in space. I mean, kind of the output of the theory is this. You get at every time a certain pattern of points. And then you hope, well, that this looks like tables and chairs.
So
what the theory the says, is the theory says that the thing... Can you say it again?
Every particle that you have is necessarily a singularity.
That's probably true for massive particles. I don't know how about massless particles. I don't want to make statements about that.
Okay, and what is a graviton?
It's massless. What is a graviton? Well, it's one of these points. And then in the equations that define the motion of these points, you have certain parameters.
So the graviton is actually one of the points?
Yes.
And not something that appears in the G?
Right. There are two things, there's the G and there are the points. Graviton is one of the points.
Do you need these graviton as particles, or can you do without graviton as particles?
I don't know if there's any empirical evidence for them. I would have thought, well, if I had photon particles, I should probably have graviton particles as well, just because electromagnetism and gravity have certain parallels. But why should one have particles and the other not? So that's
the topology. It's not always necessary that you introduce particles for every degree of freedom of the wavelength. So, like, for example,
it's certainly not necessary. Well, certainly you could. You could take it out without a breakdown of the theory.
So it kind of determines your G, right? Because for your G you need this sharp G and
yes,
evaluate it at the positions of the particles.
Right.
So then it depends a lot on what your configuration is.
Right.
You have also particles for your
if you modify this theory in that way that you say, no, gravitons don't exist or photons don't exist, you will end up not just with different with different meaning of these points, you will also in fact have different trajectories for them. Because you will basically average over the photon and the graviton degrees of freedom. And you will also get a different G, the four geometry, because that depends on the configuration.
I also have a question just in general. I think that does the graviton have a specific relationship to the metric as compared to say the photon? Or does it relate pretty much in the same way, and affected pretty much the same way as the photon?
The graviton is largely governed by a creational and annihilation term in the Hamiltonian, which has some similarity to the creational and annihilation term that we have for photons. And probably this creation and annihilation term, together with the Sharpe metric, they probably play together in creating the right operators and the relation between these operators.
But at the same time, it seems there is no no immediate ontological connection between the sharp G and the graviton particles. For example, you could modify this theory in this way, that you drop the graviton particles, take them out of the theory, you say instead there are no graviton particles, you just do the sharp G, it would still work.
My question is that, so is there any idea how to dissolve singularities in cosmology or black holes, like in your own theory? Like, can that be dissolved? You know, like,
what do you mean by dissolve?
It's how, like, so people expect that the quantum theory of general relativity, there should be no singularities anymore, like when there is prior theory, so there should not be no Big Bang singularity or no black hole singularity somehow. So is there any chance of seeing that in your theory?
I don't expect that. Mm-hmm. I expect there to be singularity. In fact, I expect that at every massive particle, there should be a singularity.
Any more questions? Good.